Welcome to the Research Reimagined podcast, brought to you by Nottingham Trent University. I'm your host, Helen Darby Dowman, and I'll be inviting some of NTU's brightest minds to explore how their research is helping us to deepen our understanding of the world. From online addictions to transgender rights and sleep disorders, listen as we discuss some of society's most pressing challenges and uncover some of the ways our research is making a difference. Our mental health is important because it affects everything we do, from making choices to connecting with others and even changing the world around us. Mental health varies for everyone and can impact daily lives differently. It encompasses a broad range of experiences, from diagnosed disorders to times where we're feeling really low. Mental health issues affect one in four people at some point in their lives and can have a profound influence on employee welfare, often leading to prolonged absences from the workplace. So what actions can employees, managers and employers take to support mental health in the workplace? Today I'm joined by Zara Weisel and Steve Brown from the Nottingham Business School, who are here to give some useful advice on how to make our workplaces better for mental health. They'll be sharing practical tips and ideas on how to create a supportive and positive environment where everyone can thrive. Zara, Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here.
Mental health is a commonly spoken about topic nowadays, but do we really understand what it means and the impact it has on those that suffer?
Well, when we talk about mental health, we're talking about a wide range of different things. We're going all the way through from the ups and downs of everyday life through to more debilitating episodes and periods of crisis, perhaps, all the way through to severe and enduring conditions like psychosis or hearing voices. And then there's lots of other things which are sometimes put in with mental health, such as autism or ADHD, attention deficit hyperactive disorder, or obsessional compulsive disorders and so on. But the thing is that most definitions of mental health, such as the World Health Organization's definition, try and get away from the idea of it as a medical condition. And mental health is something that we all have. So mental health is our ability to cope with the stresses of everyday life. It's our ability to work well, to live well, to be part of our community. And within that, so mental health is something that we all have. But one of the difficulties is that it's really difficult to understand, say, to get from everyday life of the ups and downs of feeling sad. It's quite difficult then to understand what it's like to, say, feel chronically hopeless. So that can be quite difficult for us to appreciate other people's mental health, especially at the more severe and enduring end of that. And one of the big things really that's changed about mental health has been the emphasis on lived experience. So listening to people who have had experiences of severe mental health and trying to understand from their perspective how that feels. And listening, and that's on the basis of decades of activism by mental health service user groups. So that's really been the big thing that's changed about mental health, listening to people's individual lived experiences.
I mean, we all know that the pandemic obviously had a big impact on people's mental health. Do you think a lot has changed because of it or because of the conversations that were driven around it?
I think it's definitely changed the focus in terms of mental health and well-being at work, because the boundaries are so blurred now. So if you think about, well, as a manager particularly, but you know, for every employee, when they're thinking about their work-related or well-being at work compared to just generally, you know, themselves as a person, it's very hard to draw the line, because what's work, what's not work? You're often working from home for many people, although importantly, not everyone. So I think, yeah, the key thing is that the boundary between work and home has blurred a lot. It means that the impact of work and non-work on your mental health is quite hard to decipher now. And that's an important thing for employers, because they are responsible for, you know, managing the impact of health, sorry, of work on your mental health. And if it's very hard to try and draw the line as to where does work end and home start, then that becomes quite tricky.
There is a lot of talk about mental health in the workplace. But can we explore a little bit about, through the work you guys have done, whose responsibility is it to look after employees that are struggling with mental health?
I mean, it's everybody, really. Everybody's got a role. So from individuals, we all have a responsibility to raise it, flag it. If I've got an issue with my mental health or my well-being at work, then, you know, we've all got a responsibility to raise that, to share it, ideally with your line manager, if not just somebody who you trust at work, whether that's HR or somebody else. Also to, you know, self-care, to look after yourself, to, you know, get good sleep, look after yourself in all of those different ways. Employers absolutely have a responsibility. I've sort of referenced their responsibility to make sure that work isn't detrimentally impacting on mental health and health generally speaking. Things like risk assessments and, you know, creating a good environment, providing training, all of those things so that people, you know, feel capable to do their jobs, aren't completely bewildered, you know, all sorts of things. We could go into more detail later. Anyone else you'd add in, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, employers have legal responsibilities around this, and those are very clearly defined. But the extent to which employers then are able to provide over and above what their legal responsibilities are is where it starts to get interesting. And obviously that becomes more complex the bigger the organisation is. So in a smaller organisation, there could just be one person who has it as part of their job to look out for mental health issues. But in larger organisations, that becomes a lot more complicated. And sometimes that falls in between human resources as their responsibility, occupational safety and health. There sometimes can be separate wellbeing teams, so it can start to become quite complex. Mm-hmm. And there can be issues really of, you know, where the ball sits in that complexity.
So companies have brought in various mental health and wellbeing initiatives. Are they really being useful and are they helpful?
There was a recent study by William Fleming that looked at some of the more individual level things. So this is things like mindfulness or mindfulness apps, or whether you have some kind of, you know, relaxation activity at the individual. Now that study found that there's not a lot of effect when it's just focused on the individual. So if you're just saying here is something for you to manage your own stress, that doesn't seem to be terribly effective. There's better evidence that when you're more systematic, when you take a whole organisational approach, then you can generate some effects. But one of the difficulties is, what is it you're trying to measure? Are you measuring people going off sick, absenteeism? Are you measuring people in the workplace? And this is Zara's specialist area, about presenteeism, about people who are ill and probably shouldn't be there. So it's very difficult to know what you're measuring. So, I mean, for example, with presenteeism, where would you start with that?
And that's another thing that's got increasingly hard to manage as a result of increased hybrid working. The data in some of our research suggests that, well, firstly, the categories that we use are too simplistic. It's not a binary option. Do I work? Do I take sick leave? So it might be that I'll work a little bit and then I'll take, you know, some time off in the afternoon. I may or may not actually report that formally as sickness absence because of the blurred boundaries, especially now. So it's quite messy. It may also be that you stay at work, you don't take sick leave, but you either just take it upon yourself to adjust your tasks if you have the control to do that, or you speak with your manager about adapting what you have to do. That could be the physical, you know, work environment. It could just be, I can't concentrate today, therefore I'm going to just do some more mundane aspects of my job. So yeah, there are lots of different options.
And certainly one of the most kind of well-known interventions around that is mental health first aid. So I was part of a team led out of London South Bank University, which did a randomised control trial looking at mental health first aid. That's the sort of gold standard for how you evaluate anything. Now, we had some issues because of COVID, but nevertheless, the data we were able to get showed that when you compare it with just giving people, say, 3 hours of a sort of focus session around well-being, the mental health first aid didn't actually increase people's health-seeking behaviour. So people weren't more likely to report mental health issues as a consequence of mental health first aid being something they had available to them. What it did do, though, was that you could see a reduction in absences, and there was a sort of a reduction in people's efficacy, so their ability to cope otherwise. And that's sort of in line with the kind of findings around Mental Health First Aid, which has been an incredibly successful program in lots of ways. I think something like 1 in 100 employees is trained in mental health first aid. But I think probably because it has been so successful, because it's spread so far, doesn't necessarily, you know, it's the sort of thing that looks like it should be doing something, and not least the idea of, you know, the using the comparison to first aid. You know, if you cut your finger at work, you know where to go to get a plaster. It kind of makes sense. There should be someone to go to chat to about your mental health. But that kind of a conversation is very difficult to, you know, have you got any paracetamols or where are the plasters kept? And the evidence that we had is that the complexity of those kind of conversations mean that people aren't necessarily following a common model, or they don't necessarily know what the end goal is of that. You know, it's not just, well, I've got the plaster on my finger, it's something more complex. So that means inevitably, I think that these system-wide interventions like mental health first aid are going to have quite varied outcomes because of the complexity of what you're trying to do.
And Steve, do you think that there's a risk that, because as you've said, it is an intervention that's been up, the uptake is good, right? Mental health first aid is something that's very common now across organisations. Is there a risk, I was just wondering as you were talking, that if companies doing that, they feel that they've ticked the box and they've done it because it's reactive, isn't it, rather than preventative? So what have you seen, or what's your view?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that mental health first aid, or, you know, in some organisations this is outsourced to an employee assistance programme, things like that, you know, you can very clearly see that you've done something, so you've met your responsibilities. But often there isn't a lot of follow-up with that. So there's not a lot of long-term evaluations as to whether those things are working. There's not a lot of evaluations about how they're actually experienced by employees. So it looks to be something that's done well. In work I've done in the maritime sector, for example, you know, maritime is really kind of challenging work. You know, it's got everything that's potentially problematic about work. It's got long hours, it's difficult work, there's a lot of shift work, there's a lot of nighttime working, all the kinds of things that are going to impact on your well-being. In the maritime sector, they have endless churn of different interventions. There are hundreds and hundreds of different interventions, and often what you see is organizations bringing these in for a bit, then there's a sort of change or reorganization, you know, they switch to a different intervention. So there's a lot of chopping and changing between these things, and not a lot of long-term evaluation about what's working. And there often tends to be a sort of a real gap between what it is that managers think they needs to be addressed and then what employees themselves want need to be addressed. So in maritime, for example, you know, one of the things we found is that seafarers on vessels will say, well, what I really want is, you know, better 4G access when we're at sea. I want to make sure I can buy SIM cards when we're in port. I want to talk to my family more. You know, be nice if, you know, we could choose what was in the gym because we don't like some of the machines that you've put in there. You know, so having the autonomy to decide what they would like seems to work a lot better than, you know, buying in a package that involves, you know, say, you know, a guided approach to thinking about your own well-being. So it's partly about that sort of match between employees and employers.
So in terms of the challenges then, so that's obviously an example. We talked about hybrid working earlier. What have we seen the changes perhaps and the challenges with hybrid working and the support for employees with mental health or well-being challenges?
I mean, I think it's tricky, isn't it, for employers particularly, and I often come from more of a perspective of the employer and the manager, because you can't see your people as much, you know, physically can't see them. So the risk is that you have less opportunity to notice when things, you know, aren't as you might hope them to be, to notice when somebody's struggling, to notice when they're suffering from any health problem. So I think, first of all, it just increases the need to check in with people. You know, obviously people also need to, you know, do the same, flag things. If you're experiencing issues, particularly if you're working remotely more, flag it to your manager or somebody in the workplace.
So your work, Zara, is a lot with presbyterism. You've done a lot of work in that area. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what this is and what the research that you've done has shown?
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting with what's been in the press recently as well, in terms of stats showing there's been an increase in long-term sickness absence, quite a big increase, an increase in disability reported and benefits being taken. And not by older people, as you might expect, because obviously we get sicker as we get older typically, but it's working age adults. And also there's an increase in younger people. So there's something, and I don't think anyone's quite bottomed it out yet in terms of what's actually going on. You know, why are more younger people experiencing health issues? But there is a possibility that it's something as a result of COVID. You know, people, as we've said, are working remotely more, less contact with other people, not just your line manager, but other people, colleagues. You know, loneliness we know is a big issue amongst older people, but I think also for when I think about my career, you know, you used to come into the office every day, you'd be around people every day. So I think perhaps people are also missing that connectivity. But coming back to presenteeism, I've already mentioned about the fact that it's quite a messy picture now, because when does work start? When does your home life start? But really it's about people working whilst they're unwell. And typically in the press, it's been portrayed as a bad thing. You know, there's always photos on the front page of people sniffling and, you know, the suggestion being you're making everyone else ill because it's contagious. Lots of it isn't that sort of health issue. That's not so much of a problem because it resolves itself quite quickly, but more presenteeism is underpinned by common mental health problems, anxiety, depression, and obviously they tend to be things that people experience for a long time. So, you know, health people would call those chronic problems, so it's not just a one day and then the next day you're fine. So people are experiencing lots of different types of chronic health problems, and they're struggling in to try to, or not even in, but to work, whether that's at home or wherever it is, trying to do their work whilst experiencing this. Now, it's not necessarily a bad thing because of a number of reasons. So occupational health has always been about rehabilitation for a start. You know, once somebody has experienced an ill health issue, then let's try to do a phased return and let's try to get people back at work, because if work is well managed, it does have benefits. I mean, obviously there's the pay, but secondly there's the purpose it can give you if it's good work, and there's a huge caveat around that, and well managed, and you know, the people are supportive, all of those things. Gives you a purpose, you get the camaraderie and the social support from your colleagues. People who engage in presenteeism talk about all of those as motives that they do this, positive ones. But also, you know, there's the negative side of presenteeism, which is when people are doing that because they feel they have to, whether that's because they feel they might lose their job. And I see in our data, we've got lots of qualitative data from diary studies of people describing the dilemma and how they try to decide what to do, about, you know, well, I experienced this, I've got a chronic health problem, I can't take another day of sick leave, I feel like I've used all of my chances, that's the kind of perception and what you hear people describing, and therefore I've got to, by hook or by crook, somehow get to work and do my work. So I suppose what I'm saying is that the perception is very different in terms of presenteeism, as it's not all bad, but also I think what you see in the press from, you know, Rishi Sunak's been talking a lot about sick note and fit note and all of these things, and there's an implication that people are slacking off. I mean, sure, I'm sure there is some of that. However, there's also a hell of a lot of people who are really trying to work, struggling through. So we've got to support them. The main point with presenteeism, I think, is don't try and eradicate it. It's kind of inevitable. You need to support people. What can we do to make sure that work doesn't make you more ill? And hopefully, let's try and make work a positive influence, something that, you know, especially for mental health problems, something that gives you some structure, gives you some social support, gives you some purpose.
So on that note then, obviously there is a level of responsibility, isn't there, within the employer, but as we've discussed, it's not always easy to understand that, particularly if people aren't in each other's company with this hybrid working model. What should people do then if they find themselves in a situation where their mental health, they feel their mental health is not being supported, or they don't know where to turn for that support? What should they do?
I'll start, Steve, and you can chip in. So, I mean, first of all, raise it with someone. I mean, ideally, a line manager. However, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, I would suggest the company needs to do something about offering some training to make their managers slightly more approachable and have better conversations. But if you don't feel comfortable doing that, you know, who else is there at work that you could raise this with? Do you have occupational health, HR potentially, even colleagues? Because, you know, that social support that can be useful. Who else would they raise it with? I mean, GPs, another key avenue. So especially if there's no occupational health in your workplace, for many small companies, that won't be the case. So Go to your GP, first port of call and one of the main ones. Steve, who else would you add?
I suppose I would just want to add to that an important question is this a me problem? Is the way I'm feeling a result of my ability to work, or is this a consequence of the way the work itself is being organised? Mm. And I would suggest having conversations with colleagues as well as having conversations with your managers. And, you know, in some workplaces that might mean having conversations with your trade union representatives and exploring about what's the best route to identify and raise what the questions are and how collaboratively between unions and employees can we explore what it is that needs to be changed about the nature of the work. I mean, there are lots of examples, you know, to take the banking sector, you know, around the financial crisis, and there were, you know, I think people within the banking sector would say we've had the scandal about the mis-selling of insurance around loans, that some of the business practices within the banking sector weren't entirely, you know, as we would expect them to be, and that people were encouraged to do things as part of their day-to-day jobs that created some moral dilemmas for them. You know, if that's the way you're working, almost inevitably you are not going to feel great about what you're doing and could, as a consequence, you know, have impact upon your mental health. And in that kind of a situation, well, that's not your fault. That's as a consequence of what you're being asked to do. Some people would call that a sort of moral injury. You know, you're being made to act against something that's part of your values. You know, those kinds of things I think need to be explored collectively as much as they need to be explored through conversations with managers and potentially GPs.
Definitely, and that kind of connects with my other area of interest, which is organisational culture. And building on what you've just said, I'd encourage employers especially to think about, if you've got the policies in place, great. However, look beyond that. It's not just about creating the policy, but what types of behaviours are we actually encouraging amongst our people? We might have a, you know, well-being policy, but are we then promoting people who do the longest hours, for instance? So just look at the alignment between what you're espousing and all the wonderful things that you're saying in terms of well-being, and the actual behaviours that you're creating through, whether it's how you reward people, how you measure them, what is role modelled by leaders, all of that, really important.
And it feels like, on the one hand, saying to your employees, we should all be kind to one another, when the way, you know, on the other hand, whilst your organisation is doing things that fundamentally don't look kind to their employees. So that aspect of modelling behaviours, or the, you know, leadership demonstrating the things that they are encouraging employees to do, I think is super important within that.
I mean, I think we'd both probably advocate management and leadership training, wouldn't we, as a fundamental starting point for mental health, which doesn't seem obvious. But if people are managed well, as you've alluded to, Steve, then, you know, it sorts out a lot of issues.
I think that's right. I think what the evidence shows us is, if you look at the number one thing that makes a difference to employee mental health, it's a good relationship to your line manager. It's being well managed by your immediate line manager is the thing that study after study tells us actually improves people's mental health. that probably should be your go-to starting point rather than thinking about mindfulness or something else, which of course can also be a part of the mix. But the crucial bit is that line management bit.
Yeah, I was going to ask actually what employers could do, but you've pretty much just summed that up really nicely. And another question I was going to ask was, like, we talk about obviously what employers or a manager should do to support those with mental health challenges. But actually, should it be limited to that? And I suppose what you're talking about is actually building cultures of looking after well-being. Mm. And so if we were to sum up what a business or an organisation should be doing, what would be the takeaways for them, you know, in terms of that culture? How do you build that? Because it does come from the top down, but I suppose everybody is responsible from that, from whatever level. But I think we can probably feel that we can't make the difference. We're all often trying to follow the leader. So is it about just being true to ourselves and breaking free, looking after our own well-being, so that then that rubs off on those that we manage or those of our colleagues around us?
All, I think we'd probably say all of the above. So culture, yes, there is a top-down influence from the leaders. We've spoken about the importance of role modelling from leaders, but there's also a bottom-up influence, you know, so the types of practices and behaviours that become normal, the norms around here, you know, how we do things around here is often spoken about in terms of culture. So I'd say in terms of sorting out your culture, yes, you need to get the policies in place. Yes, you need to make sure everybody knows what should you do if you're experiencing a health issue. So the processes as well, well communicated. But then you need to also, and most importantly, make sure that the behaviours and the attitudes, how we do things around here, is in alignment with that. And you do that through management and leadership training is one thing, but also just clarity on the types of behaviours that we want to see and that we don't want to see. So I would put it through all of the HR management tools, such as, are they the behaviours that you're promoting people on? Because you will encourage the ones that you're promoting people on. Are they, you know, what are we measuring? Because that, again, is another cue to trigger certain behaviours rather than others. So have a look at the whole system. I suppose it's not a simple answer.
Yeah, I think that looking in the round and thinking about how everything interconnects, you know, difficult as it sounds, nevertheless, if you want to get on top of thinking about mental health in the workplace, that's what it's got to be. There was some interesting work done by the National Safety Council. So they're kind of like the US equivalent of the health and safety executive we have in the UK. And during COVID, they were very interested in the impacts on people's well-being. But they also noticed during COVID in the US and across Europe, you had really the resurgence of Black Lives Matters. So, you know, coming from a different angle, that's not necessarily thinking about well-being, that's thinking about equalities issues. But in their work, they found those things were merging for people. So you couldn't sort of take apart well-being from the idea of equalities, you know. And we might add sustainability and fears around climate change. That's also kind of a part of the mix. It becomes at a certain level difficult to take apart your health and safety aspects from your equalities piece, from your sustainability. These things will start to merge. And I suppose the common factor in all of that is, what is it that makes people feel safe and what is it that doesn't make people feel safe? And to what extent does that happen in the workplace? So, you know, broader issues around equalities and not feeling safe because of who you are or your, you know, both your ethnicity or your sexuality, or, you know, because of your life history, all of those things can make you feel unsafe in the workplace without steps being put in place to kind of manage that within the workplace. But then that raises the question of, how do you think all of those things through? And all of those things, I would argue, are increasingly going to merge more and more in the future. So those kind of conversations about whose responsibility is it and what do we do as an organisation are just going to get more and more complex in the future. So instead of sort of pushing towards, let's take an individual approach where we just, you know, focus on individual people, thinking about how all of those things come together, the equalities piece, the sustainability piece, the well-being piece, that feels the organisations that start to move in that direction are in with more of a chance of getting on top of that.
I think it's a really good point. It kind of comes back to the definition that we started off with in terms of mental health, doesn't it? In terms of the breadth of it, it's not just about the absence of ill health. It goes beyond. It's to, you know, people feeling that they've got purpose and, you know, that they've got strong self-esteem, good quality relationships and all of those sorts of things.
I mean, it's an overwhelming subject, and I imagine there's an awful lot for people and businesses to unpick. So where should they start, and what can people practically do?
Sometimes it's not obvious, I think, where you start. A lot of my research has been in inpatient mental health care settings. I remember a conversation with the medical director of a large hospital, and she was saying, well, do you know, rather than thinking about the treatment and the therapies we're providing for mental health, a lot of our patients have type 2 diabetes because of their medication. I think if we sorted out the physical problems, a lot of the mental health problems would follow in their wake. Now, if you take that as a sort of a metaphor, the big thing we know about mental health is that social inequalities, social causes are a massive factor for mental health. So that kind of suggests that if you want to address mental health, you address social inequalities, you address how we live together, how we work together. So that sort of suggests as an organisation, your starting point really would be, what do we want to be as an organisation? What would it be to be a fair organisation? What would it be for people to feel well treated within this organisation? What would it feel for people to feel safe in this organisation? How could we ensure that our values as an organisation are aligned with our employees? So being a good employer is already well onto the step of thinking about how you address mental health. And that, you know, things like the experiments with 4-day working weeks, for example, which don't seem like it's the obvious place where you'd go with mental health, but that could be an important starting point, because it's about thinking about the kind of environment and the kind of employer you are and how people feel about working for you. You know, so it's not necessarily addressing mental health head on, although of course for certain aspects of mental health that is entirely what is required, but it is about more thinking more broadly about what work is and how people can find work valuable and meaningful. And that is a way into mental health.
That's a big answer, Steve. I was thinking, if you're going to start somewhere, it wouldn't be a bad place to start with training your managers to manage well. It links with what Steve was just saying, to make your workplace a good workplace. But actually, I was also thinking, as you were talking, Steve, before that, get data. Find out what... you know, is the state of play in our company? How are our people? How well are they? What types of things are they experiencing? And then you might have a better idea as to where to go from there and just get the conversation started, really.
And do you think now that mental health is far more spoken about and everyone is more aware of it, that when we're looking for work, and we're working for workplaces, that people will be looking for those bits that Steve just mentioned about a good place to work, somewhere that's got the support? And will it inevitably mean that work and employers need to have those aspects in place to be actually, I guess, attractive?
I think so. I mean, you do see data, not entirely sure how reliable it is, but the younger generations really do place a high value on, you know, this sort of stuff, purpose broadly, but also, you know, working in an organisation where well-being is valued. And also, I think things like Glassdoor, you know, it means it's so much more visible now. You can't hide these things away. Of course, you shouldn't hide these things away, but they are very visible to everybody out there looking for a job. I'm going to go and have a look at what type of organisation is this? Is it one that works their people's fingers to the bone, you know, where there's, you know, harassment, bullying, whatever going on? So, yeah, I think it is going to become even more important.
I think that generational aspect is really important. In the maritime sector, for example, there's evidence that suggests that there are difficulties recruiting younger people into that sector, because there has been a certain side to that culture of it's tough when you start, you know, but eventually it will get better. And I think there are many younger people who think, well, I don't have time for that, you know, or I don't necessarily see myself permanently in this sector. So that kind of model of, you know, moving through an organisation or moving through a workplace and things will gradually get better and they have to be okay from day one, I think.
It connects a bit with my research in talent management, because what you hear when you're talking to people about career aspirations is, actually, I've looked at the hours that those partners or whatever, those people at the top have to work, and I'm not sure I want that. So you do, yeah, I think that the tides are turning, or things are changing and will continue to, I'd estimate.
Thank you both so much for sharing your expertise and knowledge in the area of mental health and the workplace. It's been really interesting.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
If you want to find out more about Steve and Zara's work, please have a look in the episode description. You've been listening to the Research Reimagined podcast by Nottingham Trent University. For all of the latest news from the research community at NTU, follow us on Twitter at NTU_research or sign up to our research newsletter by visiting ntu.ac.uk/research. Thanks for listening.